on into our lesson for today. We're looking at Exodus chapter 34. Last week, we saw the Lord tell Moses, after the sin and the repentance and all that, that it was time to resume their journey and to leave Mount Sinai. And he tells him that he God, will not be personally accompanying them. His presence will not be direct, but will be through an angel. And that they will be going to a land of milk and honey that the angel will lead them to. And God said, I really can't lead you because you're an obstinate people. I shouldn't say can't. But he said, here's the if statement. If I led you, I would destroy you in a moment. So take off your ornaments, your jewelry, set them aside. And Israel did that, considered that very sad news. And we get a bit of a look at what it was like when God was with them from Moses and the people's perspective. Moses would pitch a tent that he called the tent of the meeting. And Moses would go in there and the cloud would descend and they would meet together as one friend talks to another, according to the book of Exodus. And while that was going on, Israel themselves would worship. And so God's leadership was very direct and clearly very precious to them, as well as worthy of their worship. Well, Moses entreats God concerning all that, and he says, well, you're telling me to go, but I still don't know who your angel will be. And if I've found favor in your eyes, let me know your ways that I might continue to have favor in your eyes. And in other words, continue to do things that are pleasing in your sight. And oh, by the way, don't forget, these are your people. So if you'll not be present with us, don't even take us up from here. Moses basically says, if you're not going with us, let this be the last chapter. And God tells Moses, I will do as you ask, for you have found favor with me. And I've known you by name. God makes it very personal that he knew Moses well and that he would go with him. And Moses then says, well, show me your glory. And God said that he would pass by him. But before he does, it's interesting, the first words out of God's mouth, I show mercy and grace to the ones that I decide. I'll show mercy to whom I will show mercy. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. Which is an interesting statement. It's going to come back into our lesson today again a little bit. But God makes it clear that he retains the ownership of his grace and mercy. And then God tells Moses, you can't see my face, so stand there on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I'm going to cover you with my hand. And I'll put you in the cleft of the rock. And as I go by, then I will take my hand away. And then you will see my back as I am going by in my glory. Which takes us to where we're going today, Exodus chapter 34. And we're first going to discuss the first nine verses. So let me read Exodus 34, 1 through 9. Now as the Lord said to Moses, cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. So be ready by morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. No man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere on the mountain. Even the flocks and the herds may not graze in front of that mountain. So he cut out two stone tablets like the former ones, and Moses rose up early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him. And he took two stone tablets in his hand. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him as he called upon the name of the Lord. Then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord, the God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands and who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren, to the third and fourth generations. Moses made haste to bow low toward the earth and worship. He said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, even though the people are so obstinate, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your own possession. So the Lord starts out saying, make two new tablets. make them like the ones that you destroyed when you found the big party going on and you burned with anger. And Moses had thrown them down and they were ruined. And God says, I'm again going to write on them the words that were on the ones that you destroyed. So God is going to replace those two tablets. And I'm going to go over to Exodus 31:18 real quick, if you want, back just a chapter there, just to put our eyes back on it. Just remembering what it was. When he had finished speaking, it says about God, with him upon the Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God. And so that's what's being replaced. It's what God had done himself to give them, the tablets of the testimony. So God says, be ready by morning and come up on Mount Sinai. Be there yourself and come to me on the top of the mountain. So God is saying, this is where I want to meet with you. He gave Moses the responsibility of initiating that trip up the mountain and being there. And so he also said, come alone. Keep everyone else off the mountain. Not even the animals should be out there grazing or making themselves present there on the face of the mountain. And this goes along with what God had established about the holy portion of this mountain. Go back to Exodus 19. This is where we first get the conversation with God regarding the behaviors of the people around this mountain. Looking at verses 10, 13. Here's the instructions that God gave to Moses. The Lord also said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow and let them wash their garments. Let them be ready for the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people. And when they washed their garments, he said to the people, be ready on the third day, do not go near a woman. So it came about on the third day when it was morning that there was thunder and lightning and flashes and thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So I read a little more than I planned there, but God had this boundary set. And his presence on the mountain was a big deal. The people had already said, we don't want God to do direct business with us. We're afraid. This is too scary. Moses, you have God do business with you, then you come tell us. And so these people were very much in awe of God's presence, frightened by it. They probably were right in being frightened by it, for God was going to be very clear about their borders and limitations on what they could do. And we clearly see that their own hearts were not really lined up with serving God, because look at their actions. They're so afraid of God and his presence on the mountain, and yet Moses has gone 40 days and now they've got a golden calf and they're worshiping in a very evil way. But that's the boundary that was to be set. So Moses cut out the stone tablets like the former ones. And with anybody that was called to an appointment with somebody important, Moses here is called to an appointment with the one true living God. And so he rose early and he went up to the top of the mountain. And when he gets there, the Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him as Moses called upon the name of the Lord. That is a fascinating phrase to me when I think about everything that we have read in the last few weeks in here. God is saying, you can't see my face and live, And now we have a statement that God is standing there with Moses. Can you see that God represents himself very differently in different settings? I try to imagine what this was like, and it becomes impossible very quickly when in one setting God and Moses are speaking to one another like friends. In another setting, Moses, who's there in the presence of God, says, "Let me see your glory." So there's obviously so much more to God than what Moses has been able to take in or have been given access to as the one who was leading the Israelites out of the land of Egypt. And so when he asked for it, God says, "Moses, you can't see my face and live." And yet in the next encounter, the words are, "God stood there with Moses." Indescribable. Beyond imagining, for me at least. And so they're there together, and he's standing there, and they're conversing. And then in verse 6, it gets better yet, and it says, "And the Lord passed by in front of him." Now, the passing by we saw in the last chapter, well, now you can't see me while I'm doing this, at least not anything but what will be visible as I retreat on past you. But now, God passes by right in front of him. So, I don't know. I've got my notes here are 3 question marks. That's just kind of what it is. Yes, sir?
Just the second person of the Trinity. That the only Elohim that is also Yahweh is Jesus. So, I mean, I mean, he was probably glorified. He was probably beautiful, but he was also, I don't know, angel of the Lord, kind of a.
Yeah. I don't have any squabble with the words, but at the same time, we're seeing the very same words here,
right,
to describe,
sure,
who is present.
Yes.
It doesn't sound like different aspects of the Trinity, different members of the Trinity are the ones that are, that's what's making the difference. It all sounds like, I mean, the word here is Jehovah or Yahweh, however you want to, that's the ways it's been put into our modern language. Yes? Well,
afterwards, maybe?
I don't know for sure. I mean, clearly something happens in this encounter that has not been happening previously, as far as we know. But it's going to keep happening. We're going to see as we look at some of the surrounding scriptures and what's in this passage.
Does the fact that he descended in a cloud make a difference to his glory being veiled?
You know, I wish I knew, because if I knew, I could then say, man, I'm an expert about lots of things. But I really don't know. I mean, that's a very real possibility that there's some level of shielding from the senses. I don't know. But one thing I know, two things I know, I guess, that I would say about this. The glory of God is so astounding that clearly, seeing it fully, I don't know about even the word "see my face," but seeing the glory of God fully is beyond the human opportunity and experience. Okay. This side of heaven. And the other thing I know is Moses is having a tremendous interaction with God. He's experiencing some interactions here that are very unique, atypical for people who are following God. And so he's got a wonderful opportunity here that he is using and relishing and is making good use of it in terms of his leadership with the people and his response to God. But yeah, there is a level of mystery here that is not yet revealed in terms of what's going on. As the Lord passes by in verse 6, the Lord talks about himself. He proclaims, I am the Lord God. That's the way the New American Standard does it. We'll talk about that in a minute. Compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, usually singular. Loving kindness for thousands, forgives iniquity and transgression and sin. This is God's own declaration about who he is. And how have we seen some of these attributes displayed in his decisions and interactions and planning for what he's going to be doing with the people of Israel? How have we seen him be gracious, compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, and so on, and truth?
He gave the Ten Commandments twice after the first ones were destroyed.
Well, he did. He came back and replaced what Moses destroyed, or he's going to before we're done today.
Gracious.
Yeah. What else?
He's still dealing with the stiff-necked people at all.
Yeah, they're not done being obstinate, are they? And so he's dealing with them. How, in what ways does he deal with them, showing compassion and grace?
All these times that they have forgotten after he has shown himself in crossing the Red Sea, shown himself with the water, shown himself with the manna, he continually is revealing himself, and they are continually going and turning away from him, and would show his compassion, that shows the slow anger.
Their positive responses and celebrations last something about a day, usually. Sometimes a little longer, but not much more than that. Yes, sir? What's that?
Sometimes less.
Sometimes even less.
Just that God is still keeping the covenant that he made with Abraham.
Uh-huh.
When he divided the animals and passed between them. And basically saying that if you don't maintain the covenant, if you break faith, I will pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So.
Yes, sir.
I just want to know, I'm not trying to be confrontational, but how is it gracious to kill everybody that originally left Egypt and not allow Moses into the Holy Land?
Well, I think it's...
I know.
It's very gracious, even though there's a limitation. And, sin has consequences. And God doesn't take away the consequence in sin, but the consequence of breaking the relationship with God and even being continued to be led by God, even me continuing in keeping his promises to Abraham, God shows a lot of compassion and grace in order to go ahead and continue with these people that are constantly embarrassing God, if you will. That's part of what we see. There's one thing we haven't mentioned yet, and that is that God has already said, I'm not going with you, and he's already and given the reason why that would be a proper response. And Moses says to God, I pray you, no, go with us. And God says, well, okay. Not quite in the frivolous way I just said it, but Moses lays out for him, if I found favor in your sight, these are your people. And so God agrees to continue with them with his personal presence. And I think with this, we ought to go back to Exodus 33:17-19. And I think that helps us put clarity both in what he was trying to say back in Exodus 33, as well as what he's saying right now. Exodus 33:17-19. Let me read this to you again. When we came to this, it almost fell out of context if you didn't work to understand why it was here. But the Lord says to Moses, I will do this thing which you have spoken. That is, I will go with you in person, for you have found favor in sight, and I have known you by name. And then Moses said, I'm sorry, I missed 33:17-19. Oh, yeah, no, I've got to keep reading. And then he said, I myself, verse 19, will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. And I think the significance of those words being in this general passage is extreme. Here's Moses. He came and entreated to God and said, please go with us. And God says, I'm going to do as you asked. You have found favor in my sight. But when God comes back to these words, I think God makes it very clear that it isn't that Moses made such an astounding case. It's that God himself says, I'm in charge of who I show compassion to and who I give grace to. And so it's almost saying, yeah, Moses, I'm going with you, but don't think it all depended on your request and you enlightening me as God in the things that you brought up. I'm doing this out of my sovereignty, out of my direction. And what we see when we get over here then into verse 6 of chapter 34, when the Lord passes in front of Moses, he proclaims about himself, I am Jehovah, compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth. It is not that God was a capricious God and would relish in bringing any kind of destruction or punishment on the people, but Moses somehow is maintaining a presence with God in such a way that he can ask God not to, and it's really Moses holding God back. No, God is acting out of his own intents and purposes and his own sovereign decision making on how he is going to handle the people. And I think that's important to recognize. Just for a little bit of clarity, if we go back and look at the Hebrew words used in verse 6, the New American Standard translates it, the Lord God. It's really just two words. It's Jehovah, Jehovah. And then it goes on about what he proclaimed about himself. And so that's an interesting thing. It's a double, it's a repetition. And when you repeat words like that, you know, it means that it's not just a name. This is the I am God. And there he is. And of course, God also says that by no means there in verse 6, that he leaves the guilty unpunished. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. Oh, we've been here before. Do you remember? Remember how to think about this and look at this? Is guilt transferred from one person to another? Tough passage in certain ways, isn't it? Well, let's go back to Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 6. And here God says the same thing. And there's a context for it in Exodus 20 that we ought to see. Exodus 20, 1 through 6. What's Exodus chapter 20 known for? The giving of the Ten Commandments. And so this is how God starts out. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Here's the words. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Oh, he just repeated some words. One of the things that sometimes we miss out on because we take the time to stop and dig in and we'll spend weeks on things This is Exodus 20. I didn't look up the date we talked about Exodus 20. I probably don't have enough notes left to figure it out. I probably could go on the church website and figure it out. But when you're reading between 20 and 34, if you were just reading, you might, oh, I just read that. What's the context here? What's the command he gives? What's this command right here in 1 through 6?
No idols,
and specifically, don't make any that look like
anything you know about.
Anything you know about, yeah. Things on the earth. What sin did the Israelites just commit? What's that?
Golden calf.
Yeah, golden calf. They just took the first commandment and virtually laid it out as their to-do list when Moses didn't come back for 40 days. They worshipped another god. They made and worshipped a golden calf. And his words when he gave the command were, as a jealous God, I will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And when we studied this, we also looked at Deuteronomy 24:16, and you can turn over there with you like, but I will tell you the meaning of the verse there very easily, that no brother or son or father can be punished for these relatives' failures, that only the guilt is only held by the one who committed the sin. And that sounds like justice, right? Where is the justice if every generation has to be held guilty for their parents' sins or their relatives' sins? But what God is saying here is, when you bring this into your culture, into your practices, it's not going to stay isolated. When you bring this into your practice, when you bring idolatry in, it's going to affect your relationship with God. Many of the people will become involved, and it will go throughout the generations for a period of time until you can get it stamped back out through the grace of God again. And so God is saying, you can't let this in. Bad morals corrupt the culture, and they spread through the culture. Idol worship affects the culture, and it will spread through the culture. And I don't know how far we're going to get today. We may even get to where we talk about the issue, the rules that God gives them about when they go into the promised land, how to handle the idol worship in those cultures, and the extreme measures they will have to go to if they don't want to be affected by it. And so the words are so similar. God is going back to the words he gave them when he gave them the command not to get involved with idolatry. And part of that is, this is going to affect you generationally. It's going to worm its way, it's going to find its way into the culture and be a problem for you, for your children, and for your grandchildren. And I don't think that's terribly hard to understand. Do you have any concerns for those of you that have children or grandchildren or maybe even great-grandchildren about the upcoming years? Got any concerns about that? You probably should have. As all generations have been challenged, the generations coming behind us are going to be challenged. Maybe much more greatly than we were. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't have the gift of prophecy here to bring that to you, but we understand how when these things come in, they cause problems. But that wasn't the end of what he said there in chapter 20. Because he repeated these words and even expanded on them as well. But showing loving kindness to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. And God is doing the same thing here in verse 6 of chapter 34. I'm the Lord your God. I'm Jehovah, Jehovah, compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth. But these sins are going to affect you for generations when you get involved in this idolatry. Questions, comments?
It's interesting that Hagia Sophia is the largest domed church in the Byzantine Empire. When the Muslims took it over, they built minarets on every corner, and they painted every beautiful mosaic in Hagia Sophia. It's now being uncovered, and they put Quranic character
to try to take it for their own use.
Avoid idol worship.
Kind of interesting. Yep. So how does Moses react right here? Verse 8. God has proclaimed who he is. Moses quickly bows low to the earth. Moses is showing, probably couldn't help himself. Moses is compelled when God comes there and gives this proclamation about himself to worship in the most extreme way, to humble himself as much as possible. He bows as low to the earth as he can, and he worships. Moses has a response both physically and in his attitude. He is worshiping God. In verse 9, Moses finds his voice again. I don't mean like he was struck dumb or anything. I just think it was appropriate. Now, if I found favor in your eyes, O Lord, and it's interesting here, he uses Adonai here, not Jehovah, and it may be part of the practice that was common with the Jews to not speak the word Jehovah, but speak Adonai, and it's a very reverential substitute for Yahweh or Jehovah. And the word has a meaning of Lord, as in master, not master in this case. In context, we realize it's more than just you're a boss, but you are deity. And he says, if I found favor in your eyes, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst among the people. So he's asking again. But he voices it despite. That's not the word in the New American Standard, but I think it's a good one. Despite the people's obstinance, pardon, and this is important too, Moses' words here, pardon our iniquity and our sin. He could have said, pardon their iniquity and their sin. But Moses is taking ownership of these people as his own, just as he calls upon God and says, God, remember, they're your people. And he says, take us as your possession. And so Moses is coming back to the theme that he's been using. And God has already said that he will go with them. But now Moses is getting more specific. We also are in need of a pardon. We need you to come with us. We want you to come with us. We don't want to go on without your personal presence. But we also need reconciliation. We need your pardon. And God has just said that he is a God of compassion and loving kindness. And so Moses is calling on that. Any questions or comments over these first 9 verses? Well, let's go on and start with verse 10. I'm going to read through 28, a little bit longer part of this. There in 34. Then God said, behold, I'm going to make a covenant before all your people. I will perform miracles which have not been produced in all the earth, nor among any of the nations, and all the people among whom you live will see the working of the Lord. For it is a fearful thing that I'm going to perform with you. Be sure to observe what I'm commanding you this day. Behold, I'm going to drive out the Amorite before you, and the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Watch yourself so that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, or it will become a snare in your midst. But rather you are to tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, cut down their asherim, for you shall not worship any other god. For the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Otherwise you might make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they would play the harlot with your god, with their gods, and sacrifice to their gods. And someone might invite you to eat of the sacrifice, and you might take some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters might play the harlot with their gods, and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods. You shall make for yourself no molten gods. You shall observe the feast of the unleavened bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt. The first offspring from every womb belongs to me, and all your male livestock, the first offspring from cattle and sheep. You shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey, and if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons. None shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall work 6 days, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Even during plowing time and harvest you shall rest. You shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks, that is the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year. 3 times a year all your males are to appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel, for I will drive out the nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no man shall covet your land when you go up 3 times a year to appear before the Lord your God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with the leavened bread, nor the sacrifice of the feast of Passover to be left over until morning. You shall bring the very first of the first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. All right, long passage. We won't make it all the way through that, and won't make it to my conclusion that I've got, so we'll have to save that for a while. But let's go through this for a ways. God says, look, pay attention. I'm going to make a covenant. And if we went back to chapter 24, this is right lined up with when God came off the mountain. He had been given words by God to say to the people. This is before the 40 days that we completed a while back. But he was there, and he repeated similar things to the people, and they all said, yes, we'll do it. And so here's God going back to that same kind of a thing. And in that chapter 24, they celebrated or showed their allegiance. They built an altar. They had sacrifices and this verbal consent, and Moses had written it all down then. In verse 10 here, God says, before all the people, they're going to see miracles eclipsing all previous done in any place, and will see the works of the Lord. And this is, once again, Jehovah or Yahweh. And I'm going to do fearful things. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be sobering. Now, God says this when Moses is on the mountain with him. Has he already done a few miracles?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just a few, huh? You could start with the plagues. You could start with the burning bush, but that one was limited to Moses pretty much. Moses talked about it a lot, but he's the only one that was there for it. But you've got the plagues, and you've got the various things that happened in the Exodus. You've got God leading them personally, the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. Culminating in a time when they wound up on the shores of the Red Sea, trapped by the direction God had led them. And here they were, and here's the armies of Pharaoh coming, and they got to cross on dry ground, only to watch and hear the devastation for the armies of Pharaoh and Pharaoh himself as they tried to follow in the path. And then we get over to Mount Sinai, and along the way, They're provided manna and food to eat and water when they needed it. And so God says, we're going to see miracles that eclipse, that are greater than anything you've seen yet. And it's a fearful thing that he's going to do. So he says in verse 11, be certain you're obedient to all I command this day. And I think what God is looking forward to, yes, there are going to be other miracles, even compassion that he will show them in their 40-day wanderings that will come up outside of the book of Exodus. But when they don't have the faith to go into the promised land, then there's 40 days of marching. And how many sets of clothes did they have to make? And their clothes were a little better quality than yours. They lasted 40 years. No, it wasn't the quality of the clothing. It was God's miracle. But he says, there's this fearful thing I'm going to do. And then what does he talk about? I will drive out these various tribes, the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And then verse 12, he starts talking to Moses about the danger that they will face when they go into the promised land. And it's related directly to what they have just done. Because what they have just done has at least some similarities to some of the pagan worship of the Egyptians. The Egyptians were enamored with the bovines in their gods. And they made a bovine god here. And he says, to God says to them in verse 12, make no covenants or treaties with these people living in the land that you're headed for. If you do, you will find yourselves in a trap. He says, instead, tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, cut down their asherim. And he says that pagan worship will go with those treaties. You'll wind up affirming the people and their culture, and with that, you will be affirming their worship. Just to put a little bit of clarity on some of that, in many of the foreign, I should say idolatrous worship centers, they would have high places, and they would have altars. So that's not just limited to God. They would have sacred pillars. They would make pillars that were there to show that this is a sacred place. And they would also have asherim, which were wood. Sometimes they were carved wood. Sometimes they would carve a growing tree. And asherim was a general term for these kinds of things to show this is a holy place to these pagan gods. Also, there was a god called Asherah, and not all of the Asherim were connected with the god of Asherah, but the god of Asherah was pretty prominent or in many places, and this was a Canaan fertility god. Do we need to talk more about that? Another fertility god in the mixed, and so God says, get rid of it. Get rid of all their worship centers. In verse 14, he goes back once more and says, you shall not worship any other god besides him, right? Because the Lord, Yahweh, is jealous. He's a jealous God. In this case, it's El, which is the generic term for the deity for God as an object rather than, I mean, sometimes it's used as his name as well. So he said, I'm a God. I am the righteous God, and I am jealous. And if you make covenants with them, in verse 15 he says, they would, these people that you covenant with, would play the harlot with their gods, and they would make sacrifices to them. They're playing the harlot with their gods means they would worship them. They would not be loyal to the God of Israel. They would continue to exist with their culture and their beliefs. And harlotry was often a part of their worship in a physical sense as well as in a figurative sense. And if you let them exist, I mean, God even does a little bit of what-ifing with them. Someone might invite you to eat of their sacrifice. Hey, come on over. We sacrificed a really good one the other day. Come over and enjoy the food from this sacrifice. Oh, and you might take some of their daughters for your sons as wives. And these daughters will play the harlot, will continue to worship their gods. And, you know, your sons might even join in with them. I mean, God is pretty accurately talking about what happens when you let these kinds of things into the culture. And so they have these things out there, and if you get started in it, you're going to find out that this was a trap that will suck you down into idolatry. And so in verse 17, he says the commandment from chapter 20 again, you shall not make any molten gods. Right on the heels of them having made a molten god. And then he tells them, you need to observe the feasts. Now these feasts, when were these feasts established? Do you remember? This isn't the first time we heard about these feasts, is it?
No.
Nope. As they left Egypt, God began to establish some worship things. These feasts were a part of it. And of course the main one, the first one, was a feast of unleavened bread. And it followed the Passover. 7 days of no unleavened bread. And it's in the month of Abib, which is when the Passover is. Abib became their first month. It wasn't before that. But it's the month you came out of Egypt. He's reminding them where they came from, what he had done. And then he starts talking about the firstborn, which was also a conversation God had with Moses, coming up out of Egypt. The firstborn belongs to me, God says, including the animals. In verse 20, he talks about what to do with the donkey's firstborn. If you're going to keep that donkey that was born, the firstborn male donkey, you're going to have to redeem it by sacrificing a lamb. That's what it means here, redeeming it with a lamb. And if you're not willing to sacrifice a lamb to redeem the firstborn of your donkey, then you can't let the donkey live. You have to break its neck. God's very specific about how you're going to do that. Oh, by the way, right after he says that, he says, oh, you also need to redeem your firstborn sons. He's making it clear that they're going to need to be redeemed, and that's done again through the sacrifice of a lamb. We saw that earlier. And he says, hey, you can't come before me empty-handed, meaning you can't ignore this sacrifice and expect me to ignore it. You better be bringing me your sacrifices. And by the way, what is all of this redeeming the firstborn related to? Why did God say, your firstborn is sacred to me? When they came up out of Egypt, do you remember?
Because of the Passover, all the firstborn were killed.
Yes. Unless you had the blood on your doorposts, the firstborn in your family and the firstborn male in your family and the firstborn of your animals was going to die. And Egypt had all this death and destruction. That's when they told Pharaoh, you got to let them go or we're going to all be dead. But when God gets them away from there, he says, now, I spared your firstborn. So they belong to me. And so this is what he demanded of them as a part of their worship and a part of the remembrance. He said, as you're making the sacrifice, it's an opportunity to explain all this to your firstborn children. This is why we need to do this. And you talk then, God said, about your coming up out of the Egypt and how I, God, brought you out of Egypt. And so this points back to God and his miracle in bringing them out of Egypt. And then he continues with his commands. You'll work 6 days, but on the seventh day you'll rest. And he says, including what? What did he say? Including
harvest
and what goes with plowing? Planting. Yeah, including the time you're getting your crops ready to go for the year and including the time you're harvesting them. So God said, it doesn't matter what's going on out there with your fields. I'm much more important than your harvest. And by the way, who gave you the harvest anyway is kind of implied here. And then he says we've got the celebrate of first fruits or of weeks. And it's called the Feast of Weeks because it comes so many weeks after the 50-day celebration. I can't say it. What's it? Pentecost. Thank you. I couldn't get Penta out of my head. Into my head. And so you got the Feast of Weeks, and then you've got the Feast of Ingathering, which is the fall harvest, the late fall harvest, or the turning of the year. Sometimes that feast is called the Booths or Tabernacles. That gets changed in its titling over the years. And in all three of these required feasts, all the males are to gather together. This is a point of national unification. And so if you think about the time in which they're living, what would be the vulnerability for all the men in the whole nation gathering together in one spot? What's that?
An attack.
An attack. Yeah, I'm going to give you this promised land. It's flowing with milk and honey. It's great, right? Well, he says, I'm going to drive out all of these other tribes. And as a result of doing that, no one's going to covet your land. They're not going to want to mess with me, is what God says. I'm going to make it clear how you are my special people, and it's by my might and my power that I'm clearing out the land for you, and will make you successful in your part in that. And they're not going to run the risk of attack. So he says, I'm going to drive those tribes out in verse 24. I'm going to enlarge your borders. And so you're going to be safe even as you all gather together. And you need to go up to these feasts each year before Jehovah your God. And then in verse 25, he talks to them about their sacrifices a bit. And he says, my blood sacrifice. These are the sacrifices on the altar. Blood's involved, but he says, you're not going to combine that with leavened bread. Leavened bread is unacceptable when you are making these sacrifices to be a part of what's going on with the sacrifice. And it also corresponds with the Feast of the Passover. We'll talk about that more in a moment. But in the blood sacrifice, why no leavening? It took time. That was a big part of the original piece of it.
Sin will
be represented by leavening very typically in the scriptures. And of course, going back to the original time of not leavening, God told them, commanded them not to have any leaven in the house and not to have any leavening in that period of time following the Passover and their departure from Egypt. And time was a big part of that. It signified haste, that we left in a hurry. But it also signifies obedience now. And God says, when you do the sacrifices, we're going to hold fast to that prohibition against leavening in the sacrifices then and in your time leaving Egypt and in the Feast of Weeks and in the time of the Passover. And so this is not going to become a part of the time that you worship me with sacrifice. Did you have something you wanted to add?
Just that when many times when God's describing things as being clean and unclean, that the Hebrew word for unclean has to do with like a mixture. Like it's a mixture of things that are so
okay.
So leaven, since it's a period of cleansing and being redeemed, being forgiven, you want to remove the thing that makes something unclean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Yes?
One time there was lots of Jews that came to Emporia State. I had three Jewish roommates, and it's not an ancient ritual to go through all your cabinets and make sure all the leaven is gone before the Seder. We had Seders.
Yep.
So very interesting. It remains.
So it remains amongst those that practice that and follow in the Jewish worship that way. In verse 26, he says, bring the first fruit of the crops to the house of Jehovah your God. And then he says, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. We talked about that a little bit before. Anybody remember what we talked about? Why would this be a big deal to God? Why is this something he wanted?
Wasn't a part of a pagan ritual.
Well, and you're on track of what we talked about. We really aren't even 100% sure that's true, but it looks like there was a ritual that was sometimes done as a part of Canaanite worship in specific that included sacrificing a goat and then cooking it in its mother's milk. But even that, the archaeologists / historians / biblical scholars go, well, probably, maybe, we're not sure. We really don't quite know, but we don't have to understand all of God's commands, do we? And we follow them. These commands were for these people, for the Israelite nation, and God said, this is not going to be a part of your practice. And we don't really know what connection it might have had. Now, God told Moses in verse 27, write down these words, for I have made a covenant with these words with you and with Israel. That's past tense. And Moses has written them down before, and the people didn't pay attention to him. Moses is writing them down again. And so in verse 28, we see that Moses was on the mountain again 40 days and nights, and he had no bread or water, which is the first time we've seen that stated as a part of his time with God on the mountain. Very well, he may not have had bread and water the first 40 days and nights he was there either. We don't know for sure. But here it's drawn out and mentioned. And so even his being on the mountain with God, it's a miracle to get to meet with God and have him stand in your midst, but it's also certainly a miracle that he sustained Moses for 40 days and nights without food or water. And then God wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And with that, we're out of time, so we're going to pick it up next time with verse 29 and take it on from there. So thank you, and we will catch up with you not next week. Remember, next week, big room during Sunday school. But I will catch up with you here the week after that.